When we talk about talent in musicians, we're saying they've shown achievement. It's retrospective, and there's no indicator of talent other than their success at performing or composing. Or is there? Welcome back to Accelerando. I'm Paula Tuttle, and today we're getting down to the nitty-gritty about that elusive thing we call talent. Is talent real? Is it measurable? Music is one of the only things that seems to separate people who are successful. He has talent, and the people that didn't succeed, music lessons just didn't take. There is something about Western music, the classical training in its elitist approach, that tends to dismiss the ones that don't progress rapidly. And many quit in discouragement. And one wonders if it really needs to be this way. Today, I talked to Seth Godin, or I should say, he talked to me, on his podcast, Akimbo, where I sent him my question, and he answered in a way I expected and thoroughly enjoyed. The subject was education in the arts. Seth, can you talk to education in the arts and how the future of STEAM, meaning adding arts to STEM, can impact creativity? And I was wondering, did you ever study an instrument in your public school, and how did it go? And looking back, did you feel the program was fulfilling?
Thank you, Paula. I'm a big fan of the arts, but I think that there is a very big difference between teaching kids arithmetic, that is memorizing what 4 times 4 is, and teaching them math, which is helping them understand the structures behind the way numbers dance with each other. I also think there's a big difference between teaching a kid to memorize the fingerings for B flat, getting them to play a scale over and over and over again till their eyes bleed, and helping them understand the theory, the magic, and the elegance of actual music. So STEAM is essential for our future, but we have to divorce that thinking from the authoritarian doctrinaire approach of memorization, command, and control, which is what so much of school is about. So yes, science, technology, engineering, arts, and math, all in service of solving interesting problems, in service of leadership, in service of challenging whatever status quo we are looking at. And yes, you also need to learn scales and arithmetic to do those things, but too often we push so hard for compliance that we forget that what we're really trying to do in school is train people to ask questions, train people to know how to look something up, as opposed to training them to memorize things and spit back to us what we already knew the answer could be. I have a short TED Talk about this. I'm going to insert it at the end of this episode. Thanks.
And the TED Talk he inserted goes to the question of how his own music education went. If you listen to his podcast often, you'll know he's well-educated in music, and I don't know if it was from listening or friends or his clarinet lessons. So many people find their way, so listen for yourself.
So for 8 years, I played the clarinet growing up. Well, actually, that's not true. I took lessons, but I'm not sure I actually played the clarinet. I went to hear Michael Tilson Thomas perform with a symphony orchestra, and there was a clarinetist playing a solo. And the first few notes were the middle C, the easiest note, the first note they teach you. And I realized, listening to that, that I had never actually played the clarinet. I had never once in my entire life played a single note that sounded like that note did. But all the years that I was taking lessons, no one sat me down and said, you know what? None of this matters. None of the notes and the songs and all that stuff we keep piling on for you to do matters if you can't play a single note that people actually want to hear. And I spent a lot of time thinking about that. Why was it? Part of it was that I didn't care enough. I didn't care enough to put myself into it in a way that would touch another person. And part of it is the world that we are growing up in. Quick little experiment. Go ahead and raise your right hand just as high as you can, please. Okay, now please raise it higher. What's that about? I'll tell you what it's about. What it's about is that you learned at the age of 4 that teachers and parents and coaches and bosses would always ask for a little bit more. And so it's safer to hold a little bit back. It's safer to care just a little bit less. But now we live in this world where we get a chance to dance and to leap and to hack and to do things that touch other people, right? But we're so eager to add another tweet and do another thing and put another thing on the pile because it's safer. It gives us a way to protect ourselves. You know, we make the menu longer instead of making one dish that people are willing to drive across town to buy. And so we end up with the hacker paradox, right? Number one, we need to care enough to connect, care enough to put ourselves at risk, emotional risk or any other kind of risk, to touch other people and to play one note that's worth hearing. But we also have to be brave enough to ship it before it's ready, because it's never ready. It's never the right time. Gutenberg launched the printing press when fewer than 8% of the people in Europe knew how to read. Carl Benz launched the car when it was against the law to drive, when there were no roads sufficient for cars, and when, of course, there were no gas stations or all-night drive-through liquor stores. And so the question we have to ask, given the leverage that we've been given and the way our culture is so open to notes that matter, is this. Yeah, we're probably going to succeed. The people in this room have succeeded beyond most people's dreams. That's a given. The question, as my friend Shalene told me, is not that, but will you choose to matter? Will you choose to actually make music? Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
You don't have to be Andre Agassi to enjoy playing tennis, and you don't need to be on the British baking show to enjoy cooking. We don't seem to compare ourselves in these fields the way people do in classical music. People are always coming up to me and saying they took lessons as a kid, and they often say it as if the music lessons didn't take. They quit. They left the path. This way of thinking is so wrong. More and more, the science is finding the lessons did stick, and the training benefits are lifelong. There are measurable changes in brains of musicians who reach very high levels. A scientist at Harvard, Gottfried Schlag, collected brain scans of people with perfect pitch and found that the planum temporale within the auditory cortex in individuals with perfect pitch was larger. The accepted thinking among scientists is that the planum temporale got larger. It didn't start that way. The same is true about the part of the brain that controls the left hand in violinists. It develops more, becomes larger as a result of their practice and increased precision. But both of these scientific criteria are evident after someone has reached a high level, not necessarily before. So the question of talent, it isn't really discernible before a person studies music. So they say that practice makes perfect, and I think it's really true, because they did studies among Juilliard students and found that some of the musicians practiced twice as much as the others, and those are the ones that were really successful. Time spent is the biggest factor in one's talent. And the same is true for other pursuits like chess, math, and sports. Classical musicians have learned on one very specific path. And one of the best things about the path is it leads to a legacy that can be passed down from generation to generation. But many of the greatest musicians in the world didn't learn by a classical music method. They learned by imitation, and they can get really good by going this route. Classical musicians being part of a legacy, they seem to separate themselves from those not classically trained, and I think they would do better to get rid of this notion. Especially since we are ancillaries for so many souls to come across our paths, I can't even count the number of musicians I've taught in 30 years, and how many of them became professionals? Maybe 10%? And what service have we done for those other 90%? You can't just tell them they are delegated to the unteachable, and that they're the ones with less talent. It's not true. The classical path does require a commitment in time. So some of the greatest violin teachers, say Dorothy DeLay or Joseph Gingold, who are not with us anymore, so let's say Andras Cardenas and Charles Stegman, who teach right here in Pittsburgh, they are in such demand. They have to say no to so many people. They have to say, I don't have time for you. There's a long list of people that want to be in their violin studios. And the difference with the students that get to study with the greats is mostly the time they put in. Very few people get to this level without serious practice. It's the great eliminator. I'm always blown away when I see a virtuoso musician that didn't learn on the classical path. And I'm probably not the only one that imagined during my growing up that classical training was the only path to greatness. Maybe you have a favorite pop singer that didn't study classically. Some did, but some went a different path. Billy Joel said he studied classically for 10 years. He played Chopin and Beethoven as a young pianist. And after years of writing pop music, he actually forgot how to read music. He says if you put notation in front of him today, it would look like Chinese. And I just love this story because I think it demonstrates that there's more than one path to becoming a really great musician. I worked with some wonderful musicians this week in the Broadway touring show, Hadestown. I met with the cellist, Eric Kang, who walked me through the cello book because he was switching over to the piano and music director position for a night. All of the musicians on the show were multi-talented. They were able to improvise and play more than one instrument. Eric had to learn the accordion to do the piano and MD role. And they all had the show by heart. One of the female singers, one of the Fates, she played the violin while acting. I talked to Eric about the kind of musicians they look for. And I think the productions like Hadestown and Broadway shows do look for musicians that have broader experiences and a variety of talents. People that can learn by rote, imitation, they can improvise, they can play any style, and they can read notation like a classical musician. They want the whole package. I think it's great being a classical musician, and I think it's great to have a legacy that we can pass on, but it's also important to learn other styles. Spread your wings. It was Chuck Berry's song, Johnny Be Good, that NASA attached to the Voyager spacecraft, along with Beethoven, Bach, and Mozart. Carl Sagan insisted it was included, and I, for one, am glad he did, because there's so many more kinds of music that could represent our world for eternity. Go, Johnny, go. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening. And check out Seth Godin's podcast sometime, Akimbo. I listen to it every week. See you next time.